I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Tariffs will make this country very rich. We're rich anyway, but we're rich in a certain way. We have $36 trillion in debt. I want to get rid of it, and we can do it quickly with proper deals.
China is vowing to fight to the end as President Trump threatens to increase tariffs on China to more than 100%. We'll look at how auto workers in the U.S. and Mexico are responding to Trump's trade war. Then the Supreme Court pauses a court-imposed order for the U.S. to bring home a Maryland father who was mistakenly flown to a supermax prison in El Salvador. We'll speak to the family's lawyer and go to San Salvador to look more closely at the notorious prison being used to jail immigrants sent from the United States. Then Black Americans are not surprised. That's the headline of a new piece in the New York Times by Fordham professor Christina Greer.
Black people in this particular moment are not surprised by this particular administration. What we've seen in the past, if we reckon with the real understanding of Black Americans in this country, we will understand so much of what is happening now.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Donald Trump welcomed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House Monday, where Trump repeated his call to permanently expel Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. Speaking to reporters from the Oval Office alongside Netanyahu, Vice President J.D. Vance and top cabinet officials, Trump called Gaza, quote, an incredible piece of important real estate that he wants the U.S. to own and control.
Well, you know how I feel about the Gaza Strip. I think it's an incredible piece of important real estate. And I think it's something that we would be involved in. But, you know, having a peace force like the United States there, controlling and owning the Gaza Strip would be a good thing. Because right now, all it is for years and years, all I hear about is killing and Hamas and problems. And if you take the people, the Palestinians, and move them around to different countries, and you have plenty of countries that will do that, and you really have a freedom zone.
It was Netanyahu's second visit to the White House since Trump's inauguration, coming despite an international criminal court warrant seeking his arrest for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Gaza. During the meeting, Trump said the U.S. will hold direct talks with Iran on its nuclear program in Oman this weekend. Trump, who's repeatedly threatened to bomb Iran, said if the talks don't go well, quote, Iran's going to be in great danger, unquote. In Gaza, Palestinian journalist Ahmed Mansour has died a day after suffering severe burns from an Israeli strike on a tent housing reporters in Khan Yunis. Mansour was one of three people killed in the attack, which also killed a journalist with Palestine Today. Gaza's government media office reports Israeli attacks on Gaza since October 2023 have killed at least 211 Palestinian journalists. Israeli forces have killed at least 58 Palestinians in Gaza over the past 24 hours, with several children among the dead. The United Nations warns Israeli attacks on Gaza are now killing or injuring 100 children a day. This is Ghada Dabawek, a 6-year-old girl who lost her arm with an Israeli strike last week.
I was playing at school. I was playing on the swing. I was bombed. My arm, I got injured here on my arm. My arm was amputated.
The Palestine Red Crescent Society is demanding an independent investigation into the killing of 15 Palestinian medics and rescue workers in Gaza by Israel's military March 23rd. Victims of the attack near Rafah were discovered buried in a mass grave with their vehicles, ambulances, and a fire truck buried nearby. A Red Crescent spokesperson called the attack a, quote, full-fledged war crime.
We need justice for the victims, and we need to ensure that all of those who are responsible are held to account. Without this, the crimes will continue to happen. Without this, the systematic targeting for humanitarians, aid workers, and medics will continue to happen.
Nabal Farsakh is with the Palestine Red Crescent Society. Protests against Israel's U.S.-backed war on Gaza are continuing. Here in New York, Palestinian rights demonstrators descended on Grand Central Station Monday. Elsewhere, protesters gathered in front of the U.N. headquarters to demand the protection of mothers and pregnant women in Gaza as U.N. officials held an event on maternal and newborn health for World Health Day. Separately, the group Taxpayers Against Genocide delivered a report to the U.N. Human Rights Council Monday exposing U.S. complicity in systemic injustice and human rights violations against Palestinians. Meanwhile, at Princeton University, students protested an event featuring former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. This is 21-year-old Princeton student Emmanuel Sippy, the daughter of a rabbi and president of Princeton Alliance of Jewish Progressives.
Bennett has enabled violence at the highest levels of government and public life that attempt to justify violence that cannot be justified, killing that cannot be fathomed. His presence on our campus is a desecration of God's name. To his enabling of apartheid, genocide, and annexation, Jews at Princeton say, not in our name.
Microsoft has fired two workers who protested the company's ties to Israel's assault on Gaza at its 50th anniversary celebration Friday. Microsoft supplies the Israeli military with AI and cloud technology. This is software engineer Iptahal Abusad, who organizes with the Microsoft employee-led campaign No Azur for Apartheid, confronting Microsoft AI CEO Mustafa Suleiman.
So the question I wanted to address today is really simple. What does all this mean?
Mustafa, shame on you. You say you claim that you care about using AI for good, but Microsoft sells AI weapons to the Israeli military. 50,000 people have died, and Microsoft powers this genocide in our region.
Thank you for your protest. I hear you.
You're serious. Let me know about this, Mustafa.
I hear your protest. Thank you.
You are a war profiteer. Stop using AI for genocide, Mustafa.
Last week, the BDS, that's Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee, announced Microsoft as a priority target and called on consumers to boycott its gaming subscriptions and products like Xbox. In more tech news, an Al Jazeera investigation finds Facebook hosted over 100 paid advertisements promoting illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. The ads, approved by Meta, were calls for the demolition of Palestinian homes, schools, and playgrounds, and fundraising appeals for the Israeli military. The U.S. Supreme Court Monday gave the Trump administration the green light to use the 18th century wartime Alien Enemies Act to expel Venezuelan immigrants and asylum seekers, but said that any target for removal must have the right to a court hearing. Last month, the Trump administration sent three planes with 238 Venezuelans to El Salvador in defiance of a judge's order. They were then transferred to a maximum security mega prison. On Monday, Chief Justice John Roberts also temporarily stayed a lower court's ruling, which ordered the Trump administration to bring back a Salvadoran father to his home in Maryland after he was wrongfully sent to the Salvadoran mega prison despite having protected status. Later in the broadcast, we'll get an update on the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who the Trump administration claims is unable to bring back to the United States, even though the Trump administration is paying $6 million to imprison asylum seekers and immigrants at the El Salvador prison. Meanwhile, the loved ones of Andrea Hernandez Romero, a gay Venezuelan asylum seeker who was also expelled to El Salvador, say they fear for Romero's safety at the notorious Secat mega prison. Romero appears to have been removed because he has tattoos of crowns, one on each forearm, with the words mom and dad. Experts say tattoos are not an identifier of membership in the Tren de Aragua gang, as immigration officials falsely claim. He comes from a community in Venezuela where they celebrate Three Kings Day. In more immigration news, a mother and her three children have been released from a Texas detention center nearly 2 weeks after they were taken by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in a raid at a dairy production facility near the town of Sackett's Harbor in upstate New York. The raid happened not far from the home of Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, where advocates held protests demanding the family's release. At the time of the raid, witnesses said a group of at least seven people, including the family, were handcuffed before being removed from a home at the dairy farm and put in a van. The three children were enrolled in public school, one of them in the third grade, the other two in 10th and 11th grade. The Dominican Republic is enacting a fresh series of border restrictions targeting asylum seekers from Haiti as thousands continue to flee amid political instability and a worsening humanitarian crisis. On Sunday, the Dominican president, Luis Abinader, moved to deploy hundreds of additional soldiers and ordered stepped-up surveillance along the Haitian border. He's also vowed to expedite the construction of a border wall. Dominican authorities have been repeatedly accused of widespread violence and human rights abuses against Haitians. This all comes as humanitarian groups continue to raise alarm over spiraling violence in Haiti, with more than 260 people killed during the recent gang attacks on two communities in Port-au-Prince, according to a UN report published Monday. The report details concerns with Haitian authorities and Kenyan armed forces that were deployed to Haiti, which on one occasion took at least 5 hours to respond to a gang attack. Haitians have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest the government's failure to address the security crisis, as armed gangs have now seized some 85% of the capital. President Trump has threatened to increase U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods by an additional 50% unless Beijing rescinds retaliatory tariffs imposed on U.S. goods. Trump said the new tariffs would take effect on Wednesday, raising the U.S. tariff on Chinese goods to 104%. In response, China's Commerce Ministry promised to fight Trump's tariffs to the end. After headlines, we'll look at how auto workers in the U.S. and Mexico are responding to Trump's trade war. A federal appeals court has overturned the Trump administration's firing of two top federal labor officials, ordering they be restored to their positions. Trump abruptly fired National Labor Relations Board member Gwynn Wilcox in January. Kathy Harris, who led the Merit Systems Protections Board, a judicial body that oversees protections for federal workers, was ousted weeks later. Federal law says that NLRB and MSPB members can only be fired for neglect or malfeasance. Trump officials are expected to ignore the latest ruling, likely taking the legal fight to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 2021, Wilcox became the first Black woman on the NLRB after being confirmed by the Senate following her nomination by President Biden. And a fired Justice Department lawyer is accusing her former employer of intimidation tactics after the department planned to send armed U.S. marshals to deliver a letter warning her against testifying to Congress about what she's called the ongoing corruption of the Trump administration. Liz Oyer told lawmakers Monday the marshals ultimately called off their plans to visit her home after she confirmed also receiving the warning letter via email. Oyer spent 10 years as a federal public defender before then-President Biden appointed her to serve as pardon attorney 3 years ago. She was testifying to a joint hearing convened by Democrats on the House and Senate Judiciary Committees.
The letter was a warning to me about the risks of testifying here today. But I am here because I will not be bullied into concealing the ongoing corruption and abuse of power at the Department of Justice. DOJ is entrusted with keeping us safe upholding the rule of law and protecting our civil rights. It is not a personal favor bank for the president.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Donald Trump threatened new and even higher tariffs on China Monday after imposing severe tariffs against nearly all U.S. trading partners and rattling financial markets for days. Trump told reporters Monday during a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the Oval Office, quote, "We have many, many countries that are coming to negotiate deals with us," unquote. Democrats like Senator Chris Murphy have called the sweeping tariffs, quote, "a tool to try to compel pledges of loyalty," unquote. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders has said, quote, "We need a rational and well-thought-out trade policy, not arbitrary actions from the White House," unquote. Meanwhile, the tariffs have support from some in the labor movement, including one of the most progressive unions in the country, United Auto Workers. Trump invited about two dozen auto workers to his so-called Liberation Day executive order signing last week when he announced the new tariffs and referred to them many times.
American steel workers, auto workers, farmers and skilled craftsmen, we have a lot of them here with us today. They really suffered gravely. They watched in anguish as foreign leaders have stolen our jobs, foreign cheaters have ransacked our factories, and foreign scavengers have torn apart our once beautiful American dream.
As the economic impact of Trump's tariffs played out, United Auto Workers President Sean Fain outlined possible benefits they may have for the auto industry in an interview with CBS Face the Nation before Trump outlined the tariffs.
All you have to do is look at the history of the United States, especially in auto manufacturing in the last 30 years with the inception of NAFTA and unfair trade laws. We've seen over 90,000 manufacturing facilities leave the United States. We've seen in the big three alone in the last 20 plus years, 65 plants have closed. Look, tariffs aren't the total solution. Tariffs are a tool in the toolbox to get these companies to do the right thing, and the intent behind it is to bring jobs back here.
As workers brace for uncertainty and fallout from Trump's tariffs, we'll speak in a minute with a UAW member, an auto worker in Michigan. First, this is an auto worker organizer in Mexico he put us in touch with, named Israel Cervantes, who helped found the National Independent Union for Workers in the Automotive Industry. He's a former General Motors worker. The two organized together in 2019 when Mexican GM workers refused to work overtime while GM workers in the U.S. were on strike. Cervantes explained how Trump's tariffs will impact Mexican workers.
Pues hoy vemos con este aumento de aranceles que va a tener un impacto significativo en la economía.
Today we see this increase in tariffs that is going to have a significant impact on the economy, export, competitiveness, and employment. Because by adding this tariff, companies will earn a little bit less than they were earning by exporting units, in this case in the automotive industry. However, it will also be affected by upcoming labor cuts, which will affect the economy of many families in Mexico. It also affects competitiveness because it will be a lot of competition between workers in the United States and Mexico and even Canada with these tariffs, especially since we are part of the USMCA, the Free Trade Agreement. So we see it as a mistake or as an unfair imposition. It will greatly affect both or all three countries. Regarding Trump's policies, we are definitely going to see how workers will begin to fight amongst ourselves, thinking that in Mexico we are taking jobs away from people in the United States. So the most important thing today is that unions currently present in these nations unite in solidarity to improve these policies, eliminate these policies, and unite against this president, against these decisions he's making that will only negatively affect the three countries.
That's Mexican auto worker Israel Cervantes sitting in front of a sign that said GM. Trump's tariffs will impact the vast majority of countries in the world, something like 185 countries and territories. For more, we go to Warren, Michigan, to Sean Crawford, a UAW Local 160 member who works for General Motors as well and is joining us on his break. His new piece for Labor Notes is headlined, "Will Trump's Tariffs Be Good for Auto Workers?" Sean, welcome to Democracy Now! You begin your piece talking about the man we just heard, the GM auto worker in Mexico, Israel Cervantes. Can you tell us his story and then respond, well, to your own question, the headline of how it will affect workers around, all from U.S. to Mexico?
Good morning, Amy. Happy to be here talking with you today. Israel Cervantes is a man I have a deep respect for. He unprompted went on basically a small-scale strike by refusing overtime, by refusing to produce General Motors' most profitable vehicles, the large trucks that I, at the time, was also building at Flint Truck Assembly. And I thought this was just a wonderful gesture of international solidarity, totally unprompted and uncoordinated, just pretty much done out of the spirit of solidarity. And it really flies in the face of the, you know, the negative narrative a lot of folks have about Mexican workers taking jobs and not caring about their fellow workers in the United States. And so I always go back to that for a feeling of inspiration and solidarity. And as far as, will the tariffs benefit workers in the U.S.? Honestly, it remains to be seen. I think a lot of the evidence so far points to no. And like I mentioned in the article, there's an old truism in bargaining that you really can only believe something when it's in writing. And building massive plants in the United States is not in writing. No one has agreed to it yet. No company has broken ground on any new facilities. This is something that has to be done with careful consideration of logistics and investments and the longevity of such a venture. And Trump is a particularly impulsive and erratic president, and I doubt that will be comforting enough for any company to want to break ground on something as large as a new manufacturing facility.
Sean, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the Trump is saying that the tariffs will help American workers by boosting U.S. industry and especially the auto industry. But the reality is, from the research that I've seen, in 1950, at the height of U.S. power, this country was producing 80% of all the automobiles in the world. Recently, in 2023, we were producing only 11% of all the automobiles in the world, whereas China is now producing 30% of all the cars manufactured in the world. And when it comes to electric vehicles, of the 14 million electric vehicles registered worldwide in 2023, 60% of them were registered in China. This is a stunning superiority in Chinese manufacturing that's been decades in the making. It's not just a couple of years. How will these tariffs possibly reverse this trend?
I mean, you have to keep in mind that the heyday of the American auto industry was post-World War II, when a large portion of our competition was basically bombed into the dirt. And barring another world war that results in something like that, heaven forbid, I doubt we're going to be quite in the same position as we were back in the 1950s. And there's also another factor that people often fail to consider is that the thing that made these manufacturing jobs so wonderful back in the day, and I use wonderful kind of lightly, because honestly, many manufacturing jobs are quite awful, horrible, dehumanizing, dirty, dangerous, and result in major injuries. And I can speak to that from personal experience. But nevertheless, the thing that made these jobs great, and the thing that made America great at that time, the heyday of America post-World War II, was a strong labor movement. And in order, you know, even if we do end up bringing back all these shiny new factories, unless these workers are unionized into militant independent unions that demand the value of their labor that's being extracted, we're never going to get back to anything remotely close to that. And then on top of that, you know, we have to consider the fact that automation and AI is a huge presence in our economy today. unless we address that, the effects of automation and the fact that so much more work is being done by robotics now, you know, where it used to take a whole line of workers to do something, now one robot will do the same amount of work. Unless we can figure out a way as a society to decide what is done with the products of that automation process and the value that it's creating, we're never going to see that level of prosperity again. So the discussion really needs to go further away from, you know, I hate hearing they're always harping on foreigners, but what about the capitalists that are exploiting our labor? What about the capitalists that have been screwing us over for all these years? It's not foreigners, but it's the people with money that shipped our jobs overseas. You know, these workers in Mexico and Canada. Go ahead.
Yeah, Sean, just to follow up on that issue, part of the problem in terms of producing automobiles here in the United States vis-a-vis in other countries that gets very little attention is that many other countries, including Canada, have national health insurance. So the auto makers don't actually have to pay for the health insurance of their own workers, whereas here in the United States with our privatized health care system, that falls on the automakers. I'm wondering your thoughts about how the automobile industry could become more competitive than other manufacturers if we had national health insurance or some form of government paid health insurance?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. That's honestly something I feel very strong about. It's something that I would like to see not only to make our industry competitive, but just for the economic well-being and happiness of the populace. You know, anyone who lives in the industrial Midwest who's seen the destruction and of our communities over the last 40 years to go from per capita one of the richest places in the world where, you know, workers actually shared in the wealth they created to one of the most impoverished where deaths of despair are common. We all know that the employers are not necessarily the most reliable partners. They use us up and they spit us out when it's convenient for them. And so not having health care that's reliant on your employer would be a game changer, not only for competitiveness with Canada, but also as if that's really a goal that I'm looking for, which it's not. You know, what I want is solidarity with Canada, but it would be a boon for our quality of life, our freedom to be able to choose a job or to start a venture of our own, or, you know, really just have freedom and a good quality of life.
Sean, I know you have to go back to work in a minute, but I wanted to ask you about a point that you make that's critical. Two quick questions. You write, my proposal would be to tax or tariff only those vehicles and parts, both domestic and foreign, that are produced in facilities that violate workers' rights. If you can talk about that. Mm-hmm. And then also where you differ from Sean Fain, the president of your union, the United Auto Workers.
Well, as far as strategic tariffs, like, I'm not opposed to tariffs, and I'm not opposed to protecting our industry, but what I want to see is a protection of the working class, right? Because it's not all about me. It's not all about, you know, keeping the foreigners out. If you're an American like myself, my dad is from Poland. You know, people come from all over the world to become American citizens. I have no problem with my Mexican brothers and sisters or my Canadian brothers and sisters. What I want to do is, if we're going to penalize companies for producing things the way we don't want to, how about, you know, try to imagine what it would look like, a truly pro-worker tariff policy. You know, what would empower the working class? What would strengthen the working class? And to me, what would most strengthen the working class is by punishing companies that fight unions, like Elon Musk's Tesla, for example. If you're an anti-union company, if you exploit labor, we're going to penalize you, we're going to tax you, we're going to tariff you until you, you know, actually respect your workers' rights and their ability to organize. And as far as where I differ from Sean Fain, I supported Sean Fain in the election, and I think he's done a fantastic job as UAW president. That said, I don't think Trump's tariff policies are in the best interests of the working class as a whole. And I would really like to see the tariffs applied much more strategically in a way that encompasses a mentality of solidarity, brings us closer together, and doesn't divide the working class. Because I've gotten to know over the years brothers and sisters from Mexico and Canada, and I have a great deal of respect for them. And I want to see us grow together as a working class and as a global labor movement so we can take on these companies, which are also global, because just having a nationalistic viewpoint has not been working for us and has resulted in a lot of these layoffs that we've experienced throughout the years.
Well, Sean Kerford, we want to thank you for using your break to talk to us.